Welcome to the APA Podcast, where we help one another follow Jesus at home, in our city, and around the world.
Speaking of Steph Curry, actually, one of the worst injuries that I've personally experienced is playing church pickup basketball. Those church guys are pretty serious about basketball, but I was going up for a layup, and as I came down, I landed on someone else's foot and just turned my ankle like this, tore all the ligaments in my ankle and my foot, and thankfully it didn't break, but took forever to heal. It was very painful and effectively ended the trajectory of my life toward Hall of Fame professional basketball. You're like, Steph Curry, Dave Funk could have been right up, you know, right up there. But that was painful, and it was a long recovery, and even I've got like this sympathy pain when I see athletes, when I see real athletes have like a foot or ankle injury, like I feel it in a weird way in my body, like my body's remembering that painful experience. But in seriousness, most people go through much worse things than that, and I've been through worse things, and sometimes the physical injuries we face are not even near as bad as some of the emotional, spiritual, relational injuries that we face in life. And these sorts of traumatic experiences, experience of loss, experience of pain, can be really hard to recover from. It's hard to pick up the pieces from painful experiences and find wholeness in life again. Hard, not impossible, especially when we have God in the mix. And we're seeing an example of this process in the story of Joseph as we're in the back end of the book of Genesis. Joseph started out as this spoiled kid, totally naive to the fact that his privileged status as the favorite child really affected his brothers. They became jealous of him, murderously jealous. In fact, they were going to kill him, but instead they developed this plot to sell him into slavery to get rid of him and set up this whole big lie. And imagine, like, going from a spoiled kid who probably never had to do chores to going into slavery and burden every, like, it would have been such a drastic change and obviously a traumatic season of life for Joseph to go through. His whole life had been stolen from him and he was sent down this other trajectory. How would he respond to that? Was there any possibility of recovery for him? And so when we go through something painful, we can't expect, nor should we be expected, to look back on the painful thing and say, well, it wasn't so bad. We shouldn't have to look back and say, well, what was I so upset about? That's not what we're talking about when we talk about recovering from pain. Broken bones and twisted ankles heal, but it doesn't mean it didn't hurt. And the healing of other deeper kinds of wounds can be even more difficult and sometimes even last generations. So Joseph is not expected to say, what happened to me was good. He's not expected to say, my brothers did nothing wrong. He's not expected to say, I've never been mistreated. But can Joseph and can we experience a deep kind of healing that can both acknowledge the pain and enjoy the possibility of a good future? So what we're seeing in Joseph's story is this case study in God's providence. We've defined God's providence as his ability to wisely guide the course of events toward his good purposes. God is able to take anything that's going on, any difficulty, any disruption to plans or hopes or dreams, and redirect and guide to accomplish his good purposes in the world. In Joseph's life, we've seen how God has been with him and working out the course of events toward his preferred future. So ultimately, there are two things that we'll see in this story that we can hope for our lives to come to as a part of our healing process. One, it would be great to be able to get to a point where your thoughts are no longer dominated by the painful experience. Traumatic events can stick in the forefront of your mind and make it hard to move on, hard to concentrate on other things, hard to focus on other good things in your life. It can cause intense fear of it happening again. Maybe if you experience a sports injury, you might be afraid to play that sport again. So part of what healing means is to not have that memory or that experience dominate your thoughts and dictate your actions moving forward. Another part of the healing journey is to be able to live a fruitful and fulfilling life now, even though that thing happened. Maybe whatever happened stole a version of your life away. I'm not an NBA superstar, right? But I'm working in my fallback job, right? I'm a pastor. It's worked out okay. Lord willing, a new version of life can emerge as God leads, and in his providential care, he can develop and create something that's still just as fruitful and just as fulfilling as that which was stolen. So this is the beauty and the benefit of having faith in a good and loving God, a God who exercises his providence, wisely guiding courses of events toward good outcomes. And this is what we're seeing in Joseph's life and what we'll see today as we enter the climax of the first part of his story. He had had these two dreams as a young 17-year-old kid where he would rule over his family, which caused the jealousy because he just was naive to the impact that would have on his family as he shared them. So those dreams turned into a nightmare as his brothers sold him in to slavery. His life was stolen away. But we've seen God's providential care in his life, which will bring Joseph to a place in our text today where he experiences a season of healing. So where we left Joseph was in prison. He had been tossed in jail unjustly, but God was with him there as he served and worked on being a blessing. He was elevated to the position of chief administrator in the prison. There he met two Egyptian officials who each had a dream, and Joseph, with God's help, was able to provide an interpretation for those dreams, and the interpretations came true. One official, the cupbearer, was reinstated to work with Pharaoh. The other official, the baker, was executed just as Joseph predicted. So Joseph, at the end of that text, was talking with the cupbearer and made a request. He basically said, "Will you remember me when you're back with Pharaoh?" And the request is really like, when you're with Pharaoh, hey, put in a good word for me. Let Pharaoh know that there's a guy in prison who helped you, who's here unjustly, and maybe you can use your influence with Pharaoh to help me get out of this place. But Genesis 40, verse 23 ends that text by saying, "The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him." He forgot him. This statement stands in stark contrast to God's role in the story. The human cupbearer forgot about Joseph's suffering. He forgot about Joseph's request for help. He forgot that he had served him and done something good for him, and he forgot to do something that could maybe help release Joseph. Now, the question is, will God forget Joseph? Has God moved on and left Joseph behind? Does God forget us? Does he leave us behind, deaf to our cries for help, or does God remember? So we pick up the story in Genesis 41, starting in verse 1. "When 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile when out of the river there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He fell asleep again and had a second dream. 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing along on a single stalk. After them, 7 other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the 7 healthy, full heads. Then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. In the morning, his mind was troubled, so he sent for all the magicians and wise men of Egypt. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one could interpret them for him." Some of the more observant listeners in the room may have been noticing along the course of this story this repeated pattern of twos. So Joseph had 2 dreams. There's the 2 officials who each have a dream in prison. Then Pharaoh has 2 dreams. And in fact, it was 2 years between the prison interpretation and Pharaoh's dreams. And all through the story, there's this repetition of the number 2. There's lots of different examples. And what we see is happening here is that the repetition like this of twos is an emphasis on a point. That God is firmly deciding to do something. He's firmly deciding to work a certain way in the world. He's using dreams as a way to reveal what he is doing, but God has decided to work. God has decided to work for the benefit of his creation. God has decided to bless. God has decided to work with us as his image bearers to bring his blessings in the world. God decides to do things. God decides to love us. God decides to call us, and he's firm about that decision. We can trust him that what he says he is going to do and how he says he is going to act, he will actually do it. And now this is cool because Pastor Chad pointed out last week how dream interpretation wasn't really a Hebrew thing. It wasn't something God taught his people to do or told his people to do. In fact, if anything, he didn't want them to interpret dreams. And the Bible doesn't elevate this in Old Testament or New Testament. It's not like a spiritual gift. It's not a skill that Christians are supposed to develop. God does and did often speak to his people through dreams. But when God spoke to his people through dreams, it was more obvious without need for interpretation from various images. So he would either show up and just give a vision of himself or send an angel, and it would be just someone talking and giving real, clear information, whereas these dreams of the cupbearer and baker, the dream of Pharaoh, they have these like apocalyptic image sequence that require some sort of interpretation. And what this was it was very common in the nations that surrounded Israel, but not how God worked specifically with Israel. But kings and pharaohs would employ wise men, advisors in their court to help them with dream interpretation, and they developed it into a kind of pseudoscience, where they would actually create connections between certain images and certain interpretations. They'd assign specific meanings to the images, and they'd write them down in dream interpretation manuals. So there's one example of a manual that was found that was used in the 13th century BC called the Ramesside Dream Book. And it offered specific interpretations in kind of like a concordance of images. So it had things like, if a man sees himself catching a big fish, it means profit. If a man sees himself eating crocodile flesh, it means he will become a victim of injustice. If a man sees himself losing a tooth, it means a family member will die. So there's all these really specific images that were in this concordance of dreams that if someone came to a dream interpreter, this is my dream. Okay, there's these three images there. Let's look and look it up. Here is the interpretation. So this wasn't something that God's people did, but it reminds me about another common practice in the nations around Israel that God used as a way to bring the nations to himself. If you fast forward to the birth narrative of Jesus, God used astrology, signs in the stars, to draw the wise men from the east to the birthplace of Jesus to meet the King of Kings. See, what God is doing is he's speaking the language of the nations in order to draw the nations to his truth. So he's using these dreams as a way to speak to Pharaoh because it's the language of Pharaoh. It's something he understands, but he's going to use it to draw Pharaoh to himself as he inserts Joseph into Pharaoh's life. Part of the wisdom of Joseph being displayed was being a bridger of the gap between the nations and God. So Pharaoh has these dreams about fat and skinny cows, then healthy and unhealthy stalks of wheat. And so he brings his wise men in and he says, hey, these are the images that were in my dream. Consult your manuals. What does it mean? And theoretically, they would have consulted their manuals and found there was no precedent for these images in their books. And so we're told that none of the wise men of Egypt could interpret this dream of Pharaoh's. How is this mystery going to be solved? Here's the point being made. There are some mysteries in life that no wise man and no wise woman can solve. And so what's needed is the wisdom of God. What's needed is for God to speak into the situation to bring life and meaning and purpose and wisdom and answers that we cannot find or experience ourselves. And so we pick it up in Genesis 41 in verse 9. So all of this happens, no interpretation is given. Verse 9, then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, today I am reminded of my shortcomings. The cupbearer finally remembers Joseph. He's like, hey, I know a guy. We had a guy who was part of our church named Cole, who worked with us as an intern for a while. And anytime we were in staff meeting and we're like, hey, we need this resource, or we got to try to organize this or that, literally every time, I know a guy. He just had so many connections. I miss him. They've moved away. But I know a guy, the cupbearer says. Verse 10, Pharaoh was once again angry with his servants, and he imprisoned me and the chief baker in the house of the captain of the guard. Each of us had a dream the same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. Now, a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretation of his dream. And things turned out exactly as he interpreted them to us. I was restored to my position, and the other man was impaled. So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. When he had shaved and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, and no one can interpret it, but I have heard it said that of you that you can hear a dream and can interpret it. I cannot do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. So we continue. Pharaoh recaps his dreams for him. We'll skip down to verse 25. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 years. It is one and the same dream. The seven lean, ugly cows that come up afterward are 7 years, and so are the seven worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind. They are 7 years of famine. It is just as I said to Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. Then all the abundance in Egypt will be forgotten, and the famine will ravage the land. The abundance in the land will not be remembered because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The reason the dream was given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. So Joseph remembers, Joseph provides the interpretation. Both dreams mean the same thing. Two dreams are one. The cows and the grain represents 2 7-year periods, 7 years of plenty and abundance, followed by 7 years of devastating famine, so terrible that the 7 years of abundance are completely forgotten. Now, interesting the language that's being used here, because the language used to describe the healthy cows and the healthy grain is the word good. And the word used to describe the skinny, ugly cows and the worthless scorched grain is the word evil, although that doesn't come out in the translation I've used. So what is Joseph doing as he sees these images of good and evil? He's discerning between good and evil. He's using God's wisdom. As I've said, Joseph is being presented as the ideal human. He is the bearer of God's image. He is a man full of God's wisdom. He's a new Adam, yet an Adam who didn't fall into the sin of the garden. Joseph actually overcame his temptation. We talked about how Potiphar's house was a garden scene where Joseph was tempted to see and take that which was good in his own eyes. Instead, he ran from the scene and overcame his temptation. Now he is lifted up and elevated to a place where he can bear God's image and represent God's wisdom in an incredible way. So Genesis chapter 3, verse 6 says this, Eve saw that the tree was beautiful and its fruit looked delicious, and she wanted the wisdom it would give her. See, they were tempted by the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of what? Good and evil. It's not that God was trying to keep them from knowing good and evil. It's that they were trying to discern good and evil on their own terms. They were trying to reach out and grasp and take that for which they were supposed to trust God to give them. God always planned to give Adam and Eve, his image bearers, wisdom. He always planned to give them knowledge. He always planned to teach them how to discern between good and evil, yet they wanted to short-circuit the process and define those things for themselves, and in doing so, fell into distrust of God and into sin. But Joseph, he is trusting God, and he has been given God's wisdom to discern between issues and of good and evil. He didn't seize it, he received it from God, a wisdom that no Egyptian had. None of the wise men and magicians of the land could provide what the image bearer of God could do so simply because he trusted God to give it to him. So here we see in Joseph what is possible when a human is fully surrendered to God, fully trusts in God, a human who fears God alone and rests in God's providential work to bring about good results through the course of events. But Joseph's wisdom doesn't end with dream interpretation, because wisdom is not just the ability to discern between good and evil, but wisdom also includes knowing what to do about it. So Joseph finishes his interpretation, and then he gives Pharaoh advice on what to do. Verse 33, "And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in cities for food. This food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt so that the country may not be ruined by the famine." The plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials, so Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" So Pharaoh takes Joseph, one who is full of the Spirit of God and full of wisdom, as has been described, and he puts him in charge of all of Egypt. Only Pharaoh has more authority than him. Jump down to verse 53. Joseph has put his plan into action, and it says, "The 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was food. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, 'Go to Joseph and do what he tells you.' When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. And all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe everywhere." So that last line sets up an awkward family reunion pretty soon. We'll get to that next week. But a couple more things to note in the bits we skipped over. We're told that Joseph is now 30 years old. If you remember, when Joseph had his dreams, he was 17. So Joseph has been on a very painful 13-year journey between his dreams and between being elevated into Pharaoh's court. The other thing we skipped over is that Joseph got married and started a family. And look at the announcement we see with his two kids. Verse 51, "Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, 'It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household.' The second son he named Ephraim and said, 'It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering.'" That's how I began the talk today, that when we go through a painful process and journey toward healing, these are two things that we hope for, that we can forget. Not that we literally forget, but we don't have those thoughts of pain and trauma dominate our life and dominate our actions. And secondly, that we can experience a fruitful, fulfilling life now, even if a version of our life was stolen from us. And Joseph here is testifying that through all of this, through all those 13 years of pain, the way God providentially worked and brought him to where he was able to forget, and he was able to live a fruitful life. And I think here's the key lesson. This is what I've been trying to get to all morning. There were a lot of things in Joseph's life over which he had no control. There were a lot of things done to Joseph that he didn't have a say in. But the few things he did have control, and one of them being that he could make a decision about how he would respond. He could make a decision about how he was going to treat the people around him, regardless of what circumstance he was facing. And I think there's at least one very applicable lesson that we can put into practice, regardless of whether we're in a season of pain right now or a season where we're feeling blessed right now, is that we, like Joseph, need to continue to be a blessing wherever we are as God enables us. Continue to be a blessing wherever you are as God enables you. This has been the major theme that we've tracked all through the Genesis series, that God's people were called to be a people of blessing, that he was going to bless his people, not just so that they could enjoy his blessings, but so that they could share God's blessing with the nations, revealing God's goodness to the nations around them. And here's the thing. If you are like Joseph or you know someone like Joseph, you would never fault him or tell him he's doing anything wrong for thinking only inwardly. If you had been betrayed by your family, experienced slavery and unjust jail, everyone would completely understand if you turned inward and had no energy or capacity or interest in trying to help and serve and bless other people. No one would fault you for that. I wouldn't. We'd all give them permission to focus on themselves and their needs and whatever they need to heal and rest and be restored. No one would put expectations on that person. But I think the wisdom of God that's being revealed in Joseph's life is that no matter what we're going through, we should never stop being who we're called to be just because life isn't going well for us. Think about Joseph. He had a dream that he would be a ruler. And that dream seemed to have been completely disrupted by his brother's betrayal, but it didn't stop him from doing his very best in Potiphar's house. It didn't stop him from living a life of integrity when he faced temptation. It didn't stop him when he was in jail from noticing the sadness on the faces of two of the other inmates and using his gifts and his wisdom to help them when they were frustrated by these dreams that they couldn't understand. Think about your own context. Have you stopped seeking to be a blessing because you don't feel very blessed right now? Think about another thing. We wouldn't have faulted Joseph for someone coming down to the jail and saying, hey, listen, Pharaoh's got an issue that he thinks you can handle. That he thinks you are uniquely capable of helping him out with. Joseph easily could have said, Pharaoh, that guy, I don't trust his policies. I disagree with all of his decisions, right? I'm totally for the other Egyptian political party. I'm not going to serve that guy in any way. I'm just gonna, he can suffer. Instead, Joseph wasn't thinking inwardly. He was thinking outwardly and how he can use what God has given him to be a blessing in whatever God enabled him to do. Think about the fact that Joseph's dream came true because he was willing to help fulfill the dreams of others. Joseph didn't hold back from using his wisdom and using what God had given him to bless others just because he felt like, well, if my dream's not going to come true, I'm not going to help other people. He just constantly looked for opportunities to use what God had given him to be a blessing. And it was because of that attitude, because of that orientation, that the doors kept opening for Joseph's dream to come true. He was persistent in being a blessing wherever he was. I think some of us have stopped seeking to be a blessing because we don't feel very blessed. But maybe the way out is actually to think less of ourselves and more about other people. The imagery of the famine here in this section of Genesis is intentionally shaped and described to remind the reader of the decreation event of the flood in Genesis 6. Just the opposite, right? A flood is a devastating natural disaster because there's too much water, and a famine is a devastating natural disaster because there's not enough water. Both of those are biblical images for decreation, the opposite of God creating goodness and order in the world. It's being drawn back and pulled away, which causes cataclysm. So Joseph then is actually, through the language here, he's presented as a kind of Noah. When Pharaoh puts him in charge of his household, it's a play on the word ark. And then Joseph, what does he do? He stores up food for a season of, you know, there's no food that we can actually farm. So we got to store up the food so that we can survive during this disaster. It's very much setting up this ark scene and this natural disaster where people who come into Pharaoh's household, who come to Pharaoh and to Joseph, they will be saved through the disaster. And this is what God's image bearers are designed to do. We're designed to reveal God's wisdom to the world so that people can come to God to receive salvation in the midst of cataclysmic disaster. There is a decreation event happening as we speak, as sin and death ravage the cosmos. And God has sent image bearers with his wisdom to speak his wisdom, to be a blessing, to say, hey, there's actually salvation. There's actually provision when the land isn't providing. There's a way to survive this and come out into another season of abundance on the other side. And when we are seeking to be a blessing wherever we are, regardless of the circumstance, we in this way are being God's image bearers to a world that will literally die without his blessing. Of course, Joseph's rule was temporary and his wisdom limited. In the end, he was as fallible and temporary as you and I. After Joseph's life, we actually see darkness and death once again threaten the land. If you start reading the book of Exodus, it starts out by saying, hey, there was a Pharaoh that didn't know Joseph and got really threatened by all these Hebrews in the land, and so he enslaved them. So there's this new darkness, there's this new threat that threatens God's people. Because Joseph wasn't the one true Messiah. He was an image of the coming Messiah. He was pointing ahead to the one to whom all the nations can come to experience the wisdom and salvation of God, and through whom would be led into a land and a life and eternity of abundance. The last Adam, the one true bearer of God's image, who would rule forever in God's image and his wisdom, come to rescue us from the decreating power of sin and death, drawing all nations to himself. One who helps us all forget the troubles of the past and leads us into a fruitful and fulfilling future. So we're, through Joseph's story, as we read the whole story of Scripture, we're being invited to come to Jesus. We're being invited in a scorched land, a land that is scorched by sin and death, to come to the one through whom we can receive life, to come to the one who is sent as the wisdom of God, the bearer of his image, to bring salvation and lead us to fruitfulness. Come to Jesus. Come to Jesus. He's with you now, even in a season of darkness, even in a season, you know, like look at Joseph's life. This is a case study in the way God works in the world. Like it was a 13-year season of pain he went through. Some of us give up after 13 minutes. Joseph just continued to trust, continued to use the blessing God had given him to bless others, and God used it all to bring about this amazing work of salvation in the world. God is able to do so much through a heart and a life that is fully surrendered and fully trusting of him. Band, would you come on back up? In the meantime, as you put your trust in Jesus, here's one of the ways you can actively trust him. It's not just a mental assent to a list of truth claims or just saying I trust Jesus, but how can we physically, literally, daily trust Jesus? I think it looks a lot like whatever you're going through, seek to be a blessing in the land God has put you. Whatever you're going through, continue to seek to be a blessing. Don't give in to the temptation to turn inward. No one will blame you for that. But don't give in to that temptation. Continue to use what God has given you in whatever capacity you have to be a blessing to those around you. And I think one of the things we're learning is that that's the way God guides us out into the life of fruitfulness and fullness. on the other side. We're going to sing that song again called Faithful to the End. And it's that declaration that there wasn't a day that he wasn't by our side. And sometimes we can only really fully see that in hindsight, like after you come out of a difficult season. Like, oh yeah, like I actually see how God worked. And as we move forward, again, we'll see as Joseph is going through his healing process, he looks back and he goes, oh yeah, I can see what God was doing all along the way. And then the song also, the words change in a small way at one point. It says, there won't be a day. There won't be a day that you won't be by my side. There won't be a day, whatever it is, there won't be a day that you're not by my side. It's a statement of faith for the future. If you have shown your faithfulness in the past, I know you're going to be faithful in the future. So I want to encourage each one of us, whatever part of this journey you're on, feeling blessed, not feeling blessed, feeling in God's light or feeling in the darkness of the shadow of the valley of the death. Can we sing this in faith as Pastor Peter encouraged us to earlier? There wasn't a day that you weren't by my side. There won't be a day that you're not by my side.
Thank you for listening to the APA podcast. We hope it helps you better follow Jesus in your home, city, and around the world.